Good morning. Before I start, I'd like to thank the Society for its very generous invitation and the opportunity to address you today. I've entitled my remarks, A House Divided Then and Now. And so what I'd like to do is to look at the transformation of the parties during the 1850s and try and draw some lessons from that for our contemporary politics, and hopefully that will be a useful lead-in to our discussion time. Before I do that, I would make one caveat or one limitation on looking at the transformation of parties in the 1850s, and that is this transformation, the sectional crisis, illustrates to us, I think in some very interesting ways, the limitations of the standard approach to the study of political parties, what's typically referred to as the party systems approach, going back perhaps as far as V.O. Key's essay, A Theory of Critical Elections. One of the interesting aspects of the changes of the 1850s is that while the parties changed and the issues changed, and we had a realigning, a critical election in 1860, the partisan system did not change. The method of governance, no one questioned the style of party government that had developed during the Jacksonian period. That remained unchanged. That said, the era was one of great transformation, and the Transformative Act, as Professor Bells noted in his remarks, was the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, which is arguably the most important piece of legislation in American political history. The parties of the Jacksonian period, the Whigs and the Democrats, were unable to adapt themselves in the form in which they previously existed to the new reality created by the Kansas-Nebraska Act. The old parties, the Whigs and the Democrats, had grounded their opposition to each other in lesser issues. The bank, currency, tariffs, internal improvements, presidential dominance versus legislative superiority. These parties then were predicated, and partisan conflict during the Jacksonian period was predicated upon the minimization of slavery as an issue of national importance. When slavery became unavoidable, they attempted to compromise, and the critical compromise of the Jacksonian period, of course, was the Compromise of 1850. One would note, however, as David Potter notes in his book, The Impending Crisis, that this wasn't really a compromise, that none of the sides really gave anything. There was a small block of compromisers who were willing to shift their votes on one bill and then back the other way on the next, right, in order to forge the Compromise of 1850. It was this minimization of slavery as a national political issue during the Jacksonian period that allowed the Whigs and the Democrats to function as national parties, bisectional parties. There were Northern Whigs, Northern Democrats, Southern Whigs, and Southern Democrats, and the regional wings of the two parties were able to function in uneasy harmony, but harmony nonetheless throughout the period. The Kansas-Nebraska Act made this impossible, as events were to prove. The Democratic Party didn't cease to exist, but it did fragment. The Northern Wing could not accommodate the Southern Wing, or would not accommodate the Southern Wing any longer, at least not all of them. As Leonard Richards notes in his very interesting book, The Slave Power, this had been the role of Northern Democrats ever since the days of Jefferson, which was just a role of accommodation to a dominant Southern Wing within the party. And so Northern Democrats split into two groups, supporters of Kansas-Nebraska, Douglas Democrats, and opponents, which were often referred to as anti-Nebraska Democrats. Prominent in this group would be people like Lyman Trumbull and the Blair family, who were unwilling to go along with the transformation that Douglas had initiated. As a result, politically, the Northern Democrats were wrecked as a co-equal wing of their own party. In the 1854 midterm elections, the Northern Democrats lost nearly 75% of their seats in the House of Representatives. They did make something of a comeback in 1856, which was a good year for Democrats, but they never regained their prior strength at the national level. And so as a result, the Southern wing of the Democratic Party became the dominant wing. In 1856, Buchanan was elected, and it was a good year for Democrats, but if you look at the map, he was elected by a solid South along with just enough northern states, lower north states, to secure the election, including Buchanan's own state, the critical state of Pennsylvania. The Southern Democrats set the tone for the party. It was Southern Democratic pressure and advocacy and the influence of the Southern-leaning Buchanan that made the Lecompton Constitution a party issue for Democrats. Democrats were not permitted, consistent with party discipline, Northern Democrats to vote their conscience, and it led to a further fracturing of the Democratic Party. In 1860, Southern Democrats, though unable to nominate their own candidate in the unified Democratic Convention, were able to block the nomination of Douglas, thanks to the two-thirds rule in the Democratic Party, a rule which was not abolished until Franklin Roosevelt in 1936. So, as a result, after 1854, the Democratic Party became openly the party of slavery and the party of Southern sectionalism. In the meantime, the Whig Party dissolved. There was a conflict, as our lunch speaker points out in his book, The Political Culture of the American Whigs. Daniel Walker Howe points out there's a split between first and second generation Whigs, between compromise and reform. So you have first generation Whigs who are willing to do almost anything regarding slavery in order to preserve the Union, men like Henry Clay and Daniel Webster, who become something of a pariah in his own section because of his advocacy for the Compromise of 1850. And second-generation Whigs, North and South, like William Henry Seward, Charles Sumner, Alexander Stevens, and, of course, Abraham Lincoln, who placed greater emphasis on the slavery issue and were unwilling to do almost anything. So in the end, Southern Whigs chose section over party when forced to choose. So a man like Stevens, Howe points out, picked slavery over Whiggery. And Northern Whigs, like their Northern Democratic counterparts, are no longer willing to compromise ad infinitum with slavery. They chose reform over compromise, which were elements in tension within the Whig Party throughout the 1830s and 40s. So the party went from being the second national party in 1852 to a distant and unimportant third in 1856. When its 1860 rump gathered, the Constitutional Union Party, one journalist noted that the convention was noteworthy for nothing much other than its white hair, indicating a profusion of old-line Whigs who were unwilling to abandon the old but quickly dying party. Out of the ashes of that transformation, of course, the Republican Party formed. Stan Fehrenbacher points out that it didn't happen immediately, and it didn't happen universally. It was something that happened over a course of months and years. And in Lincoln's case in particular, Lincoln continued to identify himself as a Whig for many months after the Kansas-Nebraska Act, leading up to the 1856 election. But it is incorrect to assume that the Republican Party was simply a continuation of the Whig Party. And this is in some respects where the party systems approach begins to break down, because it just plugs in a new party in its place. Well, the Republican Party was really a very different animal, and parties during this period were much more in flux. As was pointed out a few minutes ago, the new Republican Party was comprised of disparate elements. Conscience Whigs, men like Seward and Sumner, anti-Nebraska Democrats, whom we mentioned, Trumbull, the Blair family, Salmon Chase. So you had these people in tension with each other, members of old parties with old allegiances and old rivalries, and you also had new groups with new rivalries that were thrown into the mix. So on the one hand, know-nothings, at least the North Americans, tended to eventually move towards the Republican Party, men like Edward Bates of Missouri. At the same time, you had a party that was trying to attract and accommodate German Protestant immigrants. And how that was going to work with the know-nothings was, in 1854, 55, 56, to say the least, unclear. Perhaps some Free Soilers and a few political abolitionists thrown into the mix. They were united by opposition to and antipathy towards the slave power. But beyond that, it's difficult to say exactly how they spoke with one voice. And one can see, one can visualize the tension or think about the tension by noting that a not insubstantial number of anti-Nebraska Democrats returned to the Democratic Party after the Civil War. So people like Lyman Trumbull eventually was elected, became part of the Republican Party as it was formed in the 1850s, afterwards opposed the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, lost his Senate seat as a Republican, and eventually became a Democrat once again. This situation, this new party situation, is what Lincoln described in his House Divided speech. We have two parties, by 1858. But now, we have two parties that are committed to mutually incompatible understandings of justice. We have one that is committed to the rejection of the American founding, in this instance in the form of slavery, the Democratic Party, and a second oppositional party, the Republicans, right, originally the Whigs, at first the Whigs, but later the Republicans, committed to opposing the first. But again, beyond opposing the slave power, there wasn't a whole lot that united. The Republican Party. So again, you have parties that are opposed to each other, not simply on policy. It's not simply about banking or tariffs or currency. And going beyond that, not even simply based on competing interpretations of the Constitution, although they did have competing interpretations of the Constitution. That is perfectly correct to say that. But you also have parties now that are opposed to each other on the nature of justice itself and what that looks like. So at the same time, politically, you have a nation moving towards the universalization of slavery. So the Kansas-Nebraska Act, as Lincoln points out in the House Divided speech, the election of Buchanan, Dred Scott, but also a transformation in public sentiment, facilitated largely, as in Lincoln's argument, by popular sovereignty. That is to say, a doctrine of unprincipled compromise passing itself off as moderation, which threatened to transform the country by corrupting the moral foundations of Northern opposition to slavery. And as Fehrenbacher points out in his book on the Dred Scott case, this sentiment was extremely important to the North. While Southern support for slavery was based on an immediate and tangible interest, Northern opposition to slavery was based largely upon sentiment, due simply to the fact that the Southerner could see and feel and understand the impact of slavery on his life, and for the Northerner, slavery was something of an abstraction. So on this basis, Lincoln criticizes Douglas repeatedly. He tells his fellow Republicans, how can Douglas oppose the advances of slavery? Quote, he don't care anything about it. His avowed mission is impressing the public heart to care nothing about it. He tells Southerners that Douglas is doing more for them than any Southerner ever could. He tells an audience in Cincinnati, speaking rhetorically to Southerners across the Ohio River, quote, in all that there is a difference between you and him, I understand he is as sincerely for you and more wisely for you than you are for yourselves. Douglas, of all the men in this nation, is the only man that affords you any hold upon the free states. At the same time, Lincoln, among others, notes the nature of the claim to power of the new rising force of the slave power. In his Cooper Union speech, he asks the question, what will convince them? And what he means is, what will convince them that we mean them no harm? And continuing with the quote, he says, this and this only. Cease to call slavery wrong and join them in calling it right. In other words, nothing but a moral transformation of the nation will do. Slavery, in the eyes of the slave power, must be turned back from the claim that it is a necessary evil, and the new claim that it is a positive good must be advanced. The abolitionist Frederick Douglass made a similar point in his speech, The Decision of the Hour, where he says, slavery, like all other gross and powerful forms of wrong, which appeal directly to human pride and selfishness, when once admitted into the framework of society, has the ability and tendency to beget a character in the whole network of society surrounding it, favorable to its continuance. Slavery is the most stupendous of all lies and depends for existence upon a favorable adjustment of all its surroundings. Freedom of speech, of the press, of education, of labor, all kinds of freedom are felt to be a standing menace to slavery. Hence, the friends of slavery are bound by the necessity of their system to do just what the history of the country shows they have done. That is to seek to subvert all liberty and to pervert the safeguards of human rights. They could not do otherwise. It was the controlling law of their situation. Now, if I could, I'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit about the current situation in our lifetimes. Like the Jacksonian period, the New Deal period, the middle part of the 20th century, was a period of relative harmony. The Democratic Party, organized around progressive New Deal principles, dominated, with occasional interruptions, the politics of our country for more than a generation. The Republican Party was an oppositional party, but one which, by the latter stages of the New Deal period, had largely made its peace with the New Deal. Congress scholars like Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein like to talk about the gentility of this era in Congress in particular. But I suspect that this is largely because as this period wore on, the parties were both parties of the New Deal. They had made their peace with. Now, there were exceptions, the Taft-Hartley Act, for instance. But as a rule, they could disagree on this or that policy or provision or program in the details, largely because they were of the same mind regarding the fundamental principles of justice and government. And there wasn't any such thing as a well-organized, meaningful conservative opposition. Now, this did develop in the course of the 1950s and 1960s. It's interesting, though, that it developed concurrently with leftist criticisms of the progressive New Deal system, and that many of those criticisms were similar. Criticisms being made by the incipient right and the new left in the 1950s, 60s, and early 70s were similar to each other, that the New Deal system was anti-democratic, was elitist, was hostile to liberty, and to individual rights. But they developed very different views about what to do. Now, unlike the period of the 1850s, there never was, not even in the form of the Affordable Care Act, there never was a Kansas-Nebraska-like event that served to coalesce the opposition. Nevertheless, in our current situation, we have two parties. One committed to the rejection of the American founding, in this instance, in the form of modern liberalism, once again, the Democratic Party. But at the same time, a second oppositional party, the Republicans, opposed to liberalism, opposed to the modern state, but not much else. At the same time, the nation has been progressing steadily towards the permanent ensconcing of the doctrines of modern liberalism in our country over the last century plus. In the progressive era, you see the rudiments of the administrative state established in the New Deal, the rudiments of the welfare state. In the 1960s and 70s, you see the introduction into liberalism of the concept of autonomous freedom. Like the slave power in the 1850s, the new force today demands total submission and will tolerate no opposition. This is best expressed in Herbert Marcuse's very controversial essay, Repressive Tolerance, where he argues that the ways should not be blocked on which a subversive majority could develop, and if they are blocked by organized repression and indoctrination, their reopening may require apparently undemocratic means. They would include the withdrawal of toleration of speech and assembly from groups and movements which promote aggressive policies, armament, chauvinism, discrimination on the grounds of race and religion, or which oppose the extension of public services, social security, medical care, etc. Moreover, the restoration of freedom of thought may necessitate new and rigid restrictions on teachings and practices in the educational institutions which, by their very methods and concepts, serve to enclose the mind within the established universe serve to enclose the mind within the established universe of discourse and behavior, thereby precluding a priori a rational evaluation of the alternatives. In other words, the threat is you. One sees incarnations of this in the moves to silence anti-LGBT sentiment, the demands for the transformation of universities present in the demands of the Black Lives Matter movement, and so on. Now, the modern Republican Party, like the Republican Party of the 1850s, in response, is composed of disparate elements. Look at the roster of attendees for this meeting. Traditionalists, neoconservatives, libertarians, Straussians, Claremonsters, single-issue conservatives, anti-communists, fiscal conservatives, religious conservatives, social conservatives, foreign policy hawks, rhinos. Complicated by the fact that the political leadership of the movement at the national level seems to be firmly a part of the ruling class, so that there is a disjoint between rank and file and leadership. That is to say, there is no unified, principled opposition to modern liberalism. Now, of course, I think I'm running short on time. Is that correct? No. Okay. This comparison, I'm aware that this is a frightening scenario, because we know how the crisis of the 1850s ended, of course, in cataclysmic civil war. Right? This has come up in class once in a while with some graduate students. You know what you're saying, right? I do. I'm sorry. I'm trying to be empirical and follow the evidence. But we also know that in spite of that cataclysm, the result was the annihilation of great evil. And I think that if we look to that period, we can learn something about what to do, but also what to avoid. So returning to Lincoln in his House Divided speech, he says that at the end of the speech, he says that we need to be wary of the danger of false moderates, in his case Stephen Douglas, who seem like a viable middle ground but are in fact, at least in Lincoln's mind, more dangerous than the fire eaters. Lincoln knew who Calhoun was. He referenced him. He knew who the defenders of slavery were. He knew people like the Reverend Dr. Ross, who wrote a book called Slavery Ordained of God. He referenced people like that. He understood that. But that never, during the Whig period of his life, prior to 1854, that never really excited his attention on a consistent basis. And he explains in his Peoria speech that the reason that it didn't was because up until then, he claims, like most Americans, had believed that with all these compromises and controversies, slavery was still in the course of ultimate extinction. But after 1854, he says, something happened. Right? We left that course. And what caused us to leave that course was the introduction, not into the South, but into the North, of a new moral principle, right? Contained, as Professor Bells noted, in popular sovereignty. That is to say, the unlimited right of the majority to enact any policy it pleases, up to and including enslaving a portion of its population, if they so choose. He asserts at the end of the speech that the cause of liberty and self-government, the cause of the founding and of constitutionalism, can only be advanced by its own true friends. And his argument, of course, and what he spends the summer of 1858 attempting to do, is to prove that Douglas is no friend. But he recognizes that as a nation founded on based on a foundational principle, we cannot allow that foundational principle to be undermined. We can compromise on policy in the way that Henry Clay did. And so Lincoln can refer to Henry Clay as my beau ideal of a statesman. But Lincoln's own claim regarding Henry Clay is that he never compromised on principle. He never abandoned the original idea of liberty to all. That moral principle, Lincoln believed, was the source of our strength. I would suggest that there have been instances where conservatism has had the same insight. I would point to Lincoln in his Time for Choosing speech and his first annual message. And this is where I'll close with just a quick hit from that Time for Choosing speech. He says that somewhere a perversion has taken place in 1964. Our natural inalienable rights are now considered to be a dispensation of government, and freedom has never been so fragile, so close to slipping from our grasp as it is at this moment. In his first inaugural address, he says, look, this is a contest between government by consent and government by a ruling class, which will suppress all dissent. And so I would suggest in closing that we might learn something from that and profit from it in order to win the battle without fighting the war. Thank you.